Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I like Tajiri's kicks, Jerry Lawler's punches, and Stan Hansen's lariats. And I think that Emma might be the one behind the King of the Ring 99 finish, given her track record lifting cases.
I'm Carl Jones. At my age, my feet don't leave the ground, my alcoholism is about as well kept a secret as Pat Patterson's sexual orientation, and 28 years later, despite what Ken Resnick and Vern Gagne tell you, I've never felt the urge to do the Wrestle Rock Rumble.
I'm G. John Chase, and I think you should go on YouTube and check out the Baywatch episode entitled Bash at the Beach. That's right, folks, this is a WCW Baywatch crossover episode, and it's quite frankly 40 minutes of the most hilariously bad acting you'll ever see.
I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and for my dinner today I've had some particularly spicy Thai noodles. So if during the course of this podcast I disappear for 10, 15 minutes at a time, just assume I'm taking a Russo.
This is the panel for the 5th Squared Circle Gazette radio show, and you can hear us break down the good, the bad and the ugly of 1994. Next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 5th edition of Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke along with my co-host G. John Chase.
Hello.
The man whose return is more anticipated than Mike Mizanin, Carl Jones.
I hate the world and everyone that's in it.
And the illustrious Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening.
And we have a lot of feedback to get to because today's show is going to be one that I've been looking forward to doing for quite a while. When the concept for this show first came about, this was one of the ideas that I was most passionate about doing, which is a look back at certain years within professional wrestling history, and we're going to look at the good, the bad, and the ugly for 1994. I want to thank everybody for all the feedback they sent in. The way that this is going to work, we're going to hit individual talking points that we've individually selected, and then get into your feedback as well. So we're going to kick it off by talking a little bit, very, very briefly, about the context of 1994. Before we get into the individual talking points, the reason why we chose this year first is because it is kind of the baloney and the shit sandwich between 1993 and 1995, two of the all-time worst years in American wrestling history. Obviously, we're going to hit different talking points worldwide in this, but 1994 was very much a period of transition for the world of the WWF and WCW, and worldwide there was a lot going on at the same time, a lot of moving parts in 1994. So what we're going to do first, we're going to hit Kieran O'Rourke's talking point before we get into anybody else's feedback. Kieran, what about 1994? Do you want to hit a good point, a bad point, an ugly point, and what is it?
I'm hitting the greatest point of all time, in my personal opinion, and that is Shawn Michaels versus Razor Ramon, WrestleMania 10 ladder match. For me, the greatest match of all time, as a child. As I remember, it's obviously, you know, it's that against modern day ladder matches, well, probably for the last 10 years, probably more. It kind of, you know, it looks a little aged, but at that moment in time, it changed my outlook on wrestling. It was something that a match that I'd never been exposed to at that time. I wasn't exposed to, you know, hardcore wrestling. I hadn't seen wrestling from the territory days where blood and guts was more prevalent.
Violence.
Yeah, I was used to the, you know, family WWF, nice and cosy. And then Shawn came along with his ladder. I think Razor was there as well, apparently.
Oh, come on.
No. You could argue that Shawn came along with Brett's ladder if you read Brett's book.
Yeah, that's true. He's very bitter about this.
Yeah, it was Brett's idea, remember. He wanted to do the match at WrestleMania 10.
Brett's not a guest on this podcast, so he can't argue his point. So, for all intents and purposes, it's my point that counts and not Brett's.
we love you, Brett.
Just for me, at that time, it really changed my perspective on wrestling and what wrestling was. It's so exciting, it's so different for me. Obviously, I hadn't seen any previous ladder matches at that point, even the Shawn and Brett one. It was just, in terms of WWF, it was ahead of its time, probably given the context of ECW, which I'm sure we'll talk about more later. It was kind of not really ahead of its time, but it was, given its context within WWF, it was just completely game changing for me. And Shawn Michaels, I can't think I was a Shawn Michaels fan before that. I don't think I was. But yeah, for me, that match changed my outlook on wrestling. It was different. It brought something to WF that wasn't there before. I think we started seeing it come in, obviously, with Shawn as champ, with, you know, Noah Oswell match with Diesel and stuff Brett did with Diesel as well. So I think it kind of brought an element into WF that wasn't there previously. Just from a purely personal point of view, it is my favourite match of all time.
Really?
Yeah, still. Still to this day. It might be nostalgia when I watch it and I'll just get, you know,
he is Superman, he is! the thing that's really interesting about bringing up that match, and obviously you mentioned this isn't just good for you, this is the greatest of all time. The thing that's interesting is there is a lot of polarizing opinion about the ladder match, just depending on when you watched it, I think. Now, G. John Chase, the man sitting to my right, I want to know what your thoughts on this ladder match are, because if I'm not mistaken, you'd fallen out of wrestling a little bit during this period of time, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually going to be the odd one out here, because I think all you three were watching 94 when you were kids, but for me, I'd actually kind of stopped watching wrestling right at the end of 93.
You were a Hulkamaniac.
Oh, no. No, it wasn't. It's part of the Macho Madness.
Methinks the lady doth protest too much.
But I stopped watching wrestling in late 93, mainly due to my parents cancelling the Sky, so I was on...
Bastards.
I know.
We've all been there.
Okay, how do you think that match holds up when you first watched it? Because obviously a lot of the polarising opinion comes from people who watched it after the fact.
I think it's a case of the ladder match changed drastically. I think with Razor and Shawn and... sort of going further forward a few years later with Triple H and Rock. Ladder matches were more about, it's the tease of just getting to the belt. It's that sort of arduous journey. It's the one step on each rung sort of thing. And that's the way they built the drama through those matches. Shawn and Razor still had, incredible high spots for a time, splash off the ladder, all that sort of thing. But it was more about the drama of reaching the belt. Whereas now, it's very much a, what's the craziest dive off the belt? Off the ladder.
What wacky, innovative thing that we've never seen before can they come up with?
Who can run up it as a ramp sort of thing?
I think the original art of what the ladder match was has kind of been lost in recent years, as you said, due to like the spot fest that most ladder matches are now. But yeah, I was the kind of guy that actually saw this first ladder match after the first couple of TLC matches or the triple threat ladder match at WrestleMania 2000. But I'm a man of nostalgia, and I love like all the old wrestling. So I was actually able to put myself into that time frame of 94 and imagine what it's like. And I think things like knowing the work rate of Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon in that match, and also I think it being in Madison Square Garden also plays a big part in the nostalgia factor and how it comes across to
anyone.
Any
kind of classic match is always helped by environment, Kieran.
As I said myself, when you put it in modern terms against modern TLCs, etc. I fully understand that people say it's not this spectacular, and in a ladder match, that's what you're looking for. I think one thing for me, how I remembered the story of the match, it was what is Shawn going to do next with this ladder? What can he come up with to hurt this guy? And it was, I don't know, just maybe again, completely agree. It might be nostalgia contributing to this, but it just seemed, the way Shawn used the ladder, it was a lot more natural rather than setting up a spot. So he got the ladder and then he rode it. If I just want to move on quickly, still talking about WrestleMania 10, I say my favourite match of all time, for purely personal reasons, I fully accept, though, a lot of people probably disagree, it's probably the best match on the show. So
Bret Owen is a very, very strong contender. I will say, on the subject of WrestleMania 10, Glenn Stewart, a man with a very well-established opinion, I'd say looking at WrestleMania as a microcosm of the product, minimal main event roster depth, some incredible talent, and two all-time great matches on display, and the last of the WCW transition out of the WWE. WrestleMania 10, now this is an interesting topic, and I do want to get onto the actual pay-per-view itself, because for me individually, I was becoming a wrestling fan in 93, but we always had the issue of getting the shows way later, because we didn't have Sky, if I recall correctly.
No, we didn't
have access, that immediate access to the WWE. So WrestleMania 10 was the first pay-per-view, even though I was a fan for about 9 months at that point, that I got the day after it happened. And getting to see it live as it happened was absolutely unreal, because I remember we watched that ladder match for the first time and just being blown away by the baseball slide.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
A baseball slide.
Isn't that crazy? But even then, the whole show, big
slingshot
picture.
Slingshot looked good, for Christ's sake.
The slingshot was awesome. Oh, there's so many things we could talk about in that match. We could gush about that match for a long time. But again, Bret and Owen is another consensus great match. And the overall booking of the show, I thought, was pretty fantastic. The whole Bret loses to Owen, which is another fantastic shock, a great surprise, and something we'll get onto later on.
One of the best openers as well, one to the pay-per-view.
If not the best. But again, the whole theme of the show, Owen beats Bret, Bret goes on to win the world title, Lex Luger, see you later. And then at the end of the show, Owen standing in the aisle. This is a great big picture show, and considering the damage that had been done to Bret in 1993 going into this year, Bret was clearly going to be the man, and WrestleMania 10 did a lot to repair the damage.
Yeah, it was one of those few shows in wrestling where you sort of, the fans got that sense of vindication for Bret. He'd been so shabbily treated in 93 with the Yoko Resort, and we won't delve into best buddies Hogan and Bret just yet. I'm sure that's another topic for another time. But
indeed,
he was treated so poorly. And yes, he showed his skills with the King of the Ring win, which was a nice boost off the back of that. But he was feuding with Jerry Lawler.
A great feud, though. I love that feud with Lawler.
It was a good feud, don't get me wrong.
But it was a step down.
Bret deserved more than that.
I see your point.
Yeah, and he wrestling Doink at SummerSlam and that sort
don't,
of thing.
Don't be ragging on heel Doink, Carl.
No. Heel Doink was great, but again, it's that step down. And this was sort of, it was like this is the way it should have been. Here you go. We got it wrong a year ago. We're getting it right this time.
Absolutely. Now we're going to move on because obviously we've got so much to discuss when it comes to the whole year. We've spent a good few minutes talking about one individual show. So we're going to move on now. Jerry Von Kramer from Pro Wrestling Only, a man whose feedback I greatly appreciate, is discussed the good, the bad, and the ugly in his eyes. The good, WCW before Hogan comes in. They go on a pay-per-view hot streak. Super Bowl IV has Arn Anderson and Lord Steven Regal, and Vader vs. Flair rematch. Spring Stampede has Regal vs. Pillman, and the last version of Flair vs. Steamboat, Slamboree has the Funk vs. Tully Legends match. The bad, WCW about 4 or 5 months after Hogan comes in. After he's gobbled up Flair, we get to the point that Starrcade is being headlined by the fucking Butcher. And the ugly, the fake Undertaker. In fact, everything about The Undertaker in 1994, from the awful casket business at the Rumble, right through to the abomination that is the rematch with Yoko at the Survivor Series. Before we get to the Undertaker fiasco, Hulk Hogan has to be considered for one of the central themes of 1994. In terms of the good, WCW before Hogan came in was actually a very interesting period. They had a good few pay-per-views in a row. Spring Stampede 94, in particular, had a lot of good matches on.
It's just obvious that when he came in, that was like a game changer. And that's the main thing I take away from Hogan joining WCW 94, was that was a game changer. Because until then, WCW was by far the second company in America. But as soon as Hogan signed with them, that was it. That changed everything. I mean, it didn't mean they immediately became number one, but it became suddenly that company became a challenger for WWF.
It changed the face of pay-per-view for them.
And for me personally, that is when, you know, the war between WCW and WWF actually started.
I think it's a little early for the war comparison at that point. But like to your point, it certainly made them more relevant than they had been since the Crockett days. Probably.
Yeah.
The thing about Hogan is it's really interesting in the sense that I love,
there's so many angles you can look at this.
Yeah, we talk about Spring Stampede 94, and it's got a lot of great matches on that show. And the in-ring product in early 94 was very good.
Yeah.
When Hogan comes in, it's ending up with Hogan against the Butcher?
The Butcher.
The Butcher.
Brutus and Beefcake at the end of 94.
All sorts of convoluted bullshit.
Yeah.
But business did a hell of a lot better in comparison to early 94.
Well, this brought viewers in.
This is the funny dynamic, because you mention Hogan... as a part of the good. Bad is the quality of the product absolutely hit the skids, because he brought in all of his friends. He brought in Honky, he brought in Duggan, he brought in Leslie, Mr. T, Shaq. Yeah, I've got nothing against Shaq, but I mean, you know.
He brought in all his shower friends.
There is such a massive dynamic between business and product, because you had, you know, the Dustin Rhodes stud stable feud in 94 at the start. You had, like I said, you know, Vader. This was the last remnants of Vader being truly awesome. It was 1994. A great match with the Boss at Spring Stampede. When Hogan comes in and you start seeing all these, you know, again, Austin versus Steamboat, which gets a lot of love in the feedback. It's quite interesting that all these things slowly start to peter away, and you start to see Jim Duggan beating Steve Austin in 26 seconds. You start to see Honky Tonk Man, Johnny B. Bayer, Honky getting a renewed run in 1994 for some bizarre reason. And again, Hogan going through Ric Flair, ending his career, and he's against his best friend on the biggest show of the year, Ed Leslie, which, by the way, did not do very well on pay-per-view. Just in case anybody ever thought Brutus Beefcake was a draw.
That was the forfeit of signing Hogan. If you sign Hogan, he brings fans to your product, you know, all the Hulkamaniacs. But the bad side is you've got to bring all his friends as well.
Glenn Stewart also chimed in and said, from a quality dream match standpoint, how disappointing were the late 94 series of Hogan Flair matches, and how poorly WCW presented that feud. In terms of buy rates, it did pretty well for Halloween Havoc and Bash at the Beach. I will say the big negative is the way they portrayed Flair the entire way, where Flair was the guy who didn't get a look in. He got beaten twice in convincing fashion, and the only time he got one up on Hogan was at the Clash, when he wins by countout due to the whole Tonya Harding angle, if you remember that mess.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
It's all come flooding back, ladies and gentlemen. I want to get to a couple of points here from the great Rick Morris from the fdhlounge.blogspot.com, who is in with his thoughts. Good. The first half of the year in WCW, a real comeback from the talent misuse of 1993. This goes to the idea of the Hollywood Blondes in 1993, an awesome tag team that was split up. Cactus Jack taking those ass whippings from Vader and been rewarded with lost in Cleveland.
Oh, no.
Yeah, they really dropped the ball on a lot of the young guys. And Rick Morris's point here about the first half of the year in WCW, they started to rehab all these guys that were the WCW guys. Austin was being elevated. Dustin was being held in an important feud with a stud stable. The bad, what happened critically to WCW when Hogan and company came in, even though I'm enough of a realist to understand how it put WCW in the minds of super casuals for the first time ever, and was the first step towards the Monday Night Wars.
Yeah, I'd say, I think what you've got is interesting as well, without probably Meltzer here. Hey Dave, thanks for the plug.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I say, I mean, business pretty much doubled overnight with Hogan, pay-per-view wise, for 3-4 shows, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know, interesting how would the makeup of the audience, because I'd assume he'd take a lot of former WF fans with him, being to the new audience, and then how would they, did they chase off WCW fans because the product changed to a bit more WF light styly?
Yeah, well, WCW fans were loyalists because there was always that undercurrent of Flair supporters, especially when he really jobbed out Flair, who really got a sour taste in their mouth. And it more came to fruition in 95, especially on the live Nitros when they couldn't doctor the audio.
Yeah, it was just that fresh shine that he got. I mean, like he was the same thing was starting to happen in WWF towards his end of his period there, and it was just like he was moving to a new company,
long in the tooth.
You get all the new publicity, which is what Hogan was great at. That's like the thing in terms of like bringing audience in. He brought in great publicity in the papers and the press and so on, and then it was just the same thing as WWF. It's just like the shine fades and you start realizing what you're stuck with.
He took all of the elements of the WWF that he felt worked, even if it was a dated vision, and he moved it to WCW, and because it was fresh, I think it worked at first. Again, we talked before about fresh versus stale on a previous podcast. I think that fresh cut bit of Hogan in the new environment in perceived dream matches against Flair and against Vader did big. Again, against Beefcake, not so much, but those the iconic WCW guys against Hogan did do big.
Yeah, well, you've got that sort of nice little scenario where he's almost spent, I could be slightly out with the time frame here, but he's been away from the ring for close to, if not just over, a year following the Yoko.
He'd done some work in New Japan, but yeah.
So to a North American audience, you've got that sort of refresh, if you like. Oh, we haven't seen this guy for a while. Oh, it's nice to have him back. Reminds me of when I was watching it 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, kind of thing. Roller Macca from TPWW mentions as part of The Bad, WCW becoming the Hulk Hogan soap opera, going from focusing on multiple talented athletes to Hulk Hogan's arrival, Hulk Hogan's Pastamania, Hulk Hogan on other Turner shows, bringing in his buddies Mr. T and Beefcake Booty Man, main eventing Starrcade in 94 just for turning on Hulk Hogan. I'm not sure that's turning on Hulk Hogan or turning on Hulk Hogan.
A little bit of A, a little bit of B.
Indeed. Moving on to the ugly point that Jerry Von Kramer raised about the fake Undertaker. Surely this is going to generate some interest.
Yeah, I mean, it's Undertaker, Mark Calloway, whatever you want to refer to him as, taking on Brian Lee.
Who sucks.
This is the man who was a member of the Disciples of Apocalypse was the fourth most useful member, if you want to put it that way. He ranked lower in the pecking order than the Harris twins, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, when you're below the Harris twins on the useful gauge, Undertaker and Undertaker went on last. It was the main event of the show. It closed the pay-per-view. It was terror, and the crowd was dead silent. It was so surreal.
I mean, ignoring the obvious ridiculousness of cloning one of your own superstars and having them face each other, for me, the part I probably hated most about that was for the actual SummerSlam show was that whole Leslie Nielsen angle that they were doing.
Some where people he, like he, that.
It was just that whole angle.
Some people mentioned this is good in the feedback.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, it was just really bad comedy. And it was just like, he's looking for the real Undertaker. And, you have that followed by like a really bad match. It was just like...
Really bad.
That was a... Yeah. God, I hated that.
I don't understand why you can't clone a wrestler. You can clone a sheep. Why can't you clone a wrestler? Explain.
Even if you can clone a sheep, you shouldn't put it on pay-per-view.
I forgot my flip chart, so I can't do the presentation for you.
That may seem like a whimsical throwaway comment. However...
I'd like to see you tie this to something.
However, I've just perused my stats for pay-per-view buys for 1994. It appears SummerSlam 94 did outdraw all of Hogan's matches for the same year.
Really?
Yes.
325,000 buys off the top of my head, I think it was, right, for SummerSlam 94?
Worldwide.
Yeah, 325, and I think it's pretty...
Around 220 for Hogan's, for like 3 or 4 in a row, 220 for Hogan's, 235 North America for SummerSlam, 300 something worldwide.
Worldwide, yeah, because I know the year before with SummerSlam 94 outdrew 93 with Luger, even though that got a significantly bigger push. I wonder how much this could, you know, we got to bring this all the way back to the Rumble of 94 with one of the all time biggest piece of shit angles where the Undertaker dies on live pay per view and goes to heaven, which actually as a kid I didn't even realize that's what it was supposed to be. I didn't connect the dots at all. I was just a complete retard. I didn't even understand that's the idea. You know, my genetic being propelled up to the roof dressed as the Undertaker is supposed to be him going to heaven.
I thought it was Jannetty finally breaking the glass ceiling.
No, not quite, Carl, not quite. Do you credit around the table? Do you think there's the Undertaker's return after his long time away that drew the buy rate, or do you think it was Bret and Owen in the climactic cage match?
Oh, I'd probably say Taker, I'd imagine. Hard to say.
As much as I would love to say it's Bret and Owen, and you know, a lot of people probably did get the show for that. But I think the boost probably does come from the fact it's The Undertaker. We haven't seen him for, what, 9 months?
Yeah.
Sorry, not 9 months. It's close. 7 months.
Yeah, seven.
It's long enough. We haven't seen him for half a year. And it's the fact that it's the SummerSlam pay-per-view. It's the second biggest show of the year. So that all ties in as well. So I think it's probably, as much as it pains me to say it, it's Undertaker's return.
Okay, well, moving on to G-Don Chase's point, because SummerSlam was, like we said, one of the bigger matches of the year with Bret and Owen, one of the better matches in a steel cage. G-Don Chase, you want to talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, my good for 1994 is actually going to be the entire Bret Hart-Owen Hart feud. I mean, which obviously pretty much accumulated at SummerSlam. I mean, this was just fantastic. I mean, it's this entire feud. For me, like, they've done plenty of, you know, brother versus brother feuds in history of wrestling, but I don't think any of them have really been quite as good as this. Obviously, just due down to the match quality, but also just they took their time with it as well, which I think was a very key thing. You know, it started all the way back at, you know, Survivor Series 93 with their, you know, the Survivor Series matchup.
Yeah, the Hart family versus Shawn and the Knights.
Yeah, and they start.
Jerry Lawler was off, you know, defending the fact that he didn't sodomize a 13-year-old.
Yeah, and you know that you know, obviously Owen starts showing signs of a heel turn there, and you cross over to the Royal Rumble where they were challenging for the tag titles, which they failed to, and it's just slowly building. You just see what like Owen's doing, and you know,
yeah,
and he
finally kicked his leg out of his.
Oh,
leg.
You kicked someone out to do it. Damn it! I was leading up to that.
Sorry,
I was leading up to that, kicking the leg out of his leg.
I don't know how you can't lead with that.
I know. Well, I was building up to it, you know. But yeah, and then obviously, as we talked about, WrestleMania 10, the opening match, which is like. I'm really kind of mixed on that one because I do agree with Kieran. The ladder match is actually a fantastic match, but so is that Bret Owen. I mean, it's so good. It was so unexpected. No one thought Owen was going to win it. The way he won the match as well was just fantastic. Yeah. Told a great story, and you know, and then the little like kind of steps along the way of, you know, Owen Hart winning the King of the Ring 94, which was like a big thing for him. And it was just 94 was a big year for Owen, and I think like because I'm a fan of Owen Hart and I liked him, and I actually thought like he did have a chance to be a champion, and I think 94 was that key point. And I think particularly for Owen Hart, that key point for me, his best chance to have been champion was SummerSlam 94 in that cage match.
Don't.
Do you think, I think maybe you're going to agree, yeah, do you think he was ever on the level? Because I just don't think they ever elevated him past mid-card.
I think they absolutely got the best out of him they could. I really do.
I don't think he was going to be a multi-time champion, but I think he could have been champion for that feud. I think if they had enough hindsight, personally for myself, I would like to have seen Owen Hart win the title in that cage match. They proceed with the angle as planned, you know, with him and Neidhart, you know, locking the cage, beating down Bret, all the Hart family trying to get in, but Owen leaves with the belt. And then they build towards those two facing each other again at WrestleMania 11. In which, and that would have been my ideal main event for WrestleMania 11, Owen defend the title against Bret, which surely that match would have been better than anything that they ended up putting on that show.
Yeah, but I think that this is one of those things. I think that modern eyes have really jaded how you might be looking at the way that the WWF Championship was booked back then, because a guy like Owen Hart, as much as I do like his work, there's no way that guy's the WWF champion for 6 months, especially in the WWF in that time and place. Not a prayer.
No, and I think I'm going to try and keep
Nor
this
should he.
As, no, I'm going to try and keep this as sort of classy as I can. I think it's a case of looking back with what unfortunately happened with Owen. It does lead people to sort of think, did he get the fair rub of the green? Was it sort of... you know what I'm trying to say? You're looking back and you're thinking, you know, someone whose life was taken away from him, did he at least get everything he wanted out of life while he was around? Was he shortchanged anywhere along the way? And I really don't think he was. I think, to Liam's point, you got as much as you could out of Owen. I know I was only a youngster at the time, but I was even shocked that he won the King of the Ring in 94. I didn't see that coming. Even after he beat Brett, which was,
you got to remember, before the Brett feud, he was a lifetime jobber in the WWF. He was, you know, teaming with Coco. Even when he was a single guy, he was getting squashed.
High energy, the new foundation.
Yeah,
all that stuff.
That's why they gave him the King of the Ring. It was that rebuilding process. But
I just think it was Brett's feud. It wasn't a brother versus brother feud. It was Brett's feud. Brett was the star.
Brett's story. It was supplemental to Brett. It was all about Brett, who was the star of the company.
Yeah. Owen wouldn't have ever got the shot if he wasn't Brett's brother. As sad as that is,
it's true.
The answer was he would never have.
But
got.
Before Brett, and the proof is, before Brett was the star, they did nothing with Owen. They had him for years.
Well, to that point, the shocking thing is, for anyone who has a little knowledge of the Action Zone, remember that show? That short-lived show. I don't think it lasted too long. That was the last singles match they actually had as part of that feud. The cage match wasn't even the end of it.
No.
It was a singles match on Action Zone, which had involvement from Davey Boy.
Yeah.
And that's the other key thing about that feud, the way it fed Davey Boy back into the promotion after he'd been away for close to 2 years.
Yeah, he'd been away for a while. Rick Morris also mentioned as part of his ugly, the WWF and the New Generation. Easily my most hated period ever. Horrid gimmicks prevented any semblance of depth in the mid-card, as only a few guys mattered, and some were usually working with guys who didn't. I think Owen was an all-time great legend, but he unfairly came off to the marks as someone who was pushed due to an empty talent pool. Vince's overt disgust with what he had to work with, combined with his steroid trial distraction, and the influence of Jerry Jarrett with a different kind of vision, made the company feel like Memphis without the charm. I do want to talk about the New Generation a little bit, because this was originally going to be my discussion point, because the campaign for the New Generation, they started at the King of the Ring, I think.
First video they had was that strange one where they were shown, like, you know, like old aeroplanes, and then cutting to the New Generation where it's like a jet fighter, and then it was like someone on a tricycle, and then cutting to like a race car.
Yeah, and it was cutting from old guys like Hogan to new vibrant dynamic performers like Mabel.
Yeah, it was all this commercial time that was similar to the whole Pepsi Max promotion. That's what it was. It was a cheap imitation of that, in truth. And it's no wonder it failed miserably as a result.
And tying in the whole the New Generation point that Rick mentions to what you just mentioned about Brett and Owen, I think it's pretty interesting that even though Brett and Owen was pretty much the backbone of the company from a storyline perspective, don't you think it's interesting that pretty much as soon as Brett got the belt, they always anchored the big shows with something else? Brett didn't even headline King of the Ring. It was headlined by Lawler and Piper, two shining examples of the New Generation at 40 plus years old headlining the pay-per-view.
Yeah.
Brett and Owen in the cage there, in theory, big climactic match, doesn't even go on last. The Undertaker does, with The Undertaker. This whole, you know, Bob Backlund beats Bret Hart for the championship in Survivor Series.
And what closes the show at Survivor Series 94? It's Taker versus Yoko in a casket match with Chuck Norris as the ringside enforcer.
Again, Chuck Norris and Leslie Nielsen are anchoring these shows as well. Andy Howard on Facebook, good for 1994 was the introduction of smaller wrestlers getting the chance to main event and not just hulking up. Bad was WCW holding down talent like Pillman and Austin again and pushing Hogan's buddies. And ugly was building up Backlund and having Diesel beat him in 9 seconds. We've hit the Hogan points. The decision to go with Diesel at the end of the year, what are your thoughts on that? Good, bad, ugly?
I think the tail end of 94 for WWF was just hideous. From sort of one end of the spectrum to the other. I think Survivor Series 94 is arguably one of the worst pay-per-views in company history. you've got the Backlund Brett title match where Davey Boy manages to trip and knock himself out on the ring steps
for about 10 minutes. No one comes to hell.
You've got
to sign that guy up.
You've got Doink the Clown and his band of midgets against Jerry Lawler and his band of midgets. Cheesy, Wheezy,
and
Queasy.
Sleazy.
These names ringing a bell with everyone. Yeah, Sleazy for a Jerry Lawler midget. There you go. And then, just to add insult to injury, you treated to the aforementioned Taker Yoko casket match, where I think the highlight of it is Chuck Norris's sidekick on Jeff Jarrett's face. And then to bookend the year, you've got Backlund against Diesel.
Yeah.
Headlining Madison Square Garden, finishing in 8 seconds, and that just sets off a motion of the 95 WWF Diesel powered, which, if anything, went in reverse if company business is
going on. So, general thoughts, though. Okay, let's just talk about this very, very briefly. Mr. Backlund, good, bad, ugly. What did you think of Backlund in this crazy heel run?
At the time, oh, no. Come on.
Don't you think if they hadn't have fucked, you know, they kind of stopped pushing Lawler after the sodomy charge, right? If they'd have gone a little bit more steady with Lawler, if they hadn't buried Lawler completely, don't you think Lawler would have been a better transitional champion than Backlund? If he'd have kept
obviously.
The heat, if he kept the heat that he had in like that SummerSlam 93 time.
Yeah, my feeling on Backlund at the time was what the fuck. So yeah, anything would have been better than
anything would have been better.
It was just.
Yeah, it's the way it came from nowhere as well. He'd been jobbing regularly on TV.
As a babyface, just not getting over at all.
Not getting over, losing to everyone in sight. Then all of a sudden, he has this sort of babyface match with Brett on Superstars. He get the slap across the face at the end of the chicken wing where he snaps. And you just think, where the hell's this come from? There's been no slow build to this. There's been no alluding to it beforehand. It's just come from nowhere. And it's just got awful.
Can you just think it was just like the biggest example of like two-faced like double standards, you know? Because it was just like, you know, they spend the year talking about the new generation and how they're going to bring all these new stars in. And yes, okay, we had, you know, Roddy Piper and Jerry Lawler main event King of the Ring.
It's almost as if the tag new generation was like a cheap PR exercise rather than some kind
almost.
Of... Almost! Come across like that! Almost!
And we might be onto something here, boys!
And we're back to Pepsi Max.
Okay, moving along. PF3 from Pro Wrestling Only mentions the good. This is a good one. I think a lot of people became tape traders in 94. The big two were probably at their lowest points. I'd argue 95 was worse. WCW had lower points commercially, but there were many, many smart fans who found the product utterly depressing once Hogan took over. ECW, for all of its faults, was like a hot underground rock band or video nasty, just waiting for some kind of commercial breakthrough, and it epitomized almost everything that was missing in the WWF and WCW. You also had Smoky Mountain having a fine year with a you've gotta see this aspect with the debut of the Gangsters and New Jack's crazy interviews, while also appealing to the more old school fan with more relatable characters. The Super J Cup was in 94 and was probably the first Japanese tape for many people, coupled with a burgeoning online community, and you had a coming together of disillusioned fans fed up with shitty mainstream wrestling and looking for something better. I think this is a really interesting point because this would play in a lot stronger in 95 again, but when we started hearing the ECW chants at King of the Ring, you know, the influence of these the Smart Mark fans on WWF pay-per-views, we saw a lot more of that. American wrestling being pretty shocking for this year in 93 and in 95. But elsewhere in the world, there was a lot of good stuff going on. And in fact, the majority of the good of this year comes from overseas.
Well, I mean, at the start of that statement, he mentions about the tape traders with ECW in particular. I mean, how influential and how important was tape trading at the beginning of ECW's
huge
run? I mean, it's how they built their popularity, particularly in the early days.
I think it's more a case of it was the tape trading that leads to the... Oh wow, there's a whole wide world out there away from North America and away from the dog shit we've been sitting through for the last year to 18 months.
I think as well, just go back to my own point, which I made.
This is very unlike you.
The about the ladder match being ahead of its time in terms of WWF at the time, I think that showed the market was there for something like ECW, something different, something extreme, something a bit rowdy, something
really
a bit dirty, gritty, exciting.
Let's mention another good thing here, the Super J Cup, which he mentioned, a show that Chris Benoit ended up winning, the tournament itself. One of the all-time great shows. There's a lot of all-time greats, internationally speaking. When Worlds Collide, the AAA pay-per-view that WCW produced, was regarded for years as one of, if not the best pay-per-view of all time. You had all this stuff overseas. The Super J Cup, like we mentioned, again, all-time great work. You know, a show that looks very good in retrospect. All these 20 years later, matches with Jushin Liger, the great Sasuke, Eddie Guerrero's Black Tiger, Chris Benoit. It's a completely different style of wrestling that people, if they had the chance, I mean, it was blowing away everything that was going on.
Yeah, I think also, like, whilst everyone obviously was looking outside of America for all this great wrestling, I think also in the long run, so was WWF and WCW, because a lot of the people that you mentioned ended up actually working for those companies. They ended up poaching them from those companies because they recognised that people were starting to turn off their product and started looking at these alternatives.
Yeah, well, especially Accelerate with the Monday Night War, but that's a different podcast for a different day. Moving on to the bad that PF3 mentioned here. Big two wrestling characters were the absolute shit. Vince was picking gimmicks out of a vocational guidance encyclopedia, and WCW was just pushing the absolute wrong people, epitomised by Evad Sullivan. I think the only new character in either company worth a damn was Mr. Backlund, because despite his over-the-top screaming act, he still felt like a real human being and not a cartoon character. So a different take in terms of where Mr. Backlund stood.
I think that's the... I'm just completely dumbfounded how he can make such a great point initially... and then just completely undermine himself with that Backlund remark.
That's hit the Backlund stuff, huh?
I think it was hideous. The nicest thing I can say about the Backlund run is that it got a bit of a laugh out of me when he said at the end of the Survivor Series promo after he won the belt, "Tonight I feel like God."
That's discipline, ladies and gentlemen!
I just think maybe the feud would have been a lot more interesting if Bob had seduced Helen Hart rather than played on her sensitivities.
You mean had some real fun with the chicken wing?
I understand this point about Bob Backlund feeling like at least it was a real person who'd gone crazy as opposed to the cartoon Duke, the Dumpster Drosies of the world. Let's not forget they brought back King Kong Bundy at the end of 1994, which was
generation.
If you thought Mr. Backlund sucked, I raise you King Kong Bundy. The Ugly! From PF3, we mentioned some of those venues the WWF was using for television. This is great. The Road to WrestleMania special from the legendary Sullivan Community Center stands out. It looks like an industrial basement. ROH would look at it and say, "Show me something better." A true sign of how far the company had fallen. I think all three of those, even with the Backlund thing that you hear, I think all three of those are outstanding. The production values are pretty shocking. In fact, Seaport from WrestlingForum.com mentioned the same thing for The Ugly. An incredible regression in WWF production values. The Road to WrestleMania TV special in a high school gym. WWF Superstars and Challenge, which were supposed to be in larger locations, were taped in areas not much larger than the Raw tapings. The addition of laser lights to the lighting grid that required artificial smoke, which in turn quickly filled the small venues with smoke and created a permanent haze on many TV shows. The WWF would finally solve this problem 3 years later when Bonnie Hammer had them get machines to remove the smoke during Raw.
Is he sure that that sort of smoke-filled rooms didn't have anything to do with Johnny Polo in the back?
C4 also mentioned for the good, Bret Hart versus Owen Hart, and the bad, the Butcher versus Hulk Hogan, which are almost unanimous across this table at least. But we got to move on to another point. So, Carl Jones, the good, the bad, and the ugly, what are you bringing to the table for 1994?
Now, I want everyone who's listening and the three of you around the table to bear with me on this one. Indulge me, if you will. Because the person I'm going to talk about here, I think, encapsulates all three to some extent. And that is none other than Lex Luger.
Yeah! of all the things you could mention about this year, I don't know why Lex Luger is... You're going to have to do a hell of a job here.
The reason I'm going with Lex Luger, let's get this clear straight away. I detest Lex Luger. Laxative Luger, because he's the shit. But 90...
How long was you working on that one?
I got to bed around 2:30.
It took that long.
The great thing was that 94 finally saw, in my opinion, the end of the Lex Luger experiment. Now, the Lex Express never got out of second gear. It stalled, ironically, in all places of Detroit for SummerSlam.
The Motor City!
It comes to a screeching halt at the Motor City, and they finally just decide to crush the bloody thing into a cube in New York. And on a personal note to the Providence, Rhode Island crowd at the Rumble 94, thank you for booing the man.
Thank you for choosing Brett and not Lex.
The bad is the fact that he was still employed.
Oh, God!
The ugly is his wrestling. The good is the fact that everyone saw sense and it ended in 94. There we go. Have at it.
Kieran O'Rourke is shaking his head in disgust. As a card-carrying member of the Lex Express, Kieran, I want you to defend Luger here.
Sorry, can I just ask before you jump in? Was he your hero?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. I fucking love the Lex Express.
I'll be your hero.
Coming over the horizon. Bit of heat haze. Oh, God, it was magic.
Aaron Neville singing the anthem at SummerSlam.
That's the only heat Lex ever had.
Until... Oh, come on.
What about the strange, like, spandex he had? What is it, like, the onesie spandex?
Oh, the Candyman outfit, the King of the Ring? Yeah. That was terrible.
Do you have that, like, in his calendar or something that you got on your wall?
I'm just saying the world would be a different place if they didn't give him a fucking count out win and then celebrate like he won the Super Bowl.
Different podcast for a different day, but Lex was ruined by the time 94 started. They tried desperately with Lex. WrestleMania 10, again, we were watching this pretty much live, as live as we could back then, one day delay. Lex Luger and Mr. Perfect, this whole incident, the Lex Express, okay, even you, a defender of the Lex Express, when it came down to crunch time and Mr. Perfect had to disqualify him, you were all in favour of Mr. Perfect.
First of all, let me just quantify this. That was 93, Lex. After SummerSlam, I didn't give a shit about him either. However,
Mr. Perfect was absolutely correct, because there were other other people in the ring. He couldn't count the three other people in the ring. He had to get those foreign people out of the ring. No, I'm talking about out of the ring before he could continue the match.
The managers from such foreign countries as Japan and Kentucky.
Yeah.
Well, Kentucky may as well be a foreign.
It's a different language. But yeah, absolutely. To make it, you know, back to a serious point, Mr. Perfect shouldn't be held responsible for the outcome of that match.
That's your story and your sticking to it, as absolutely. Mr. Perfect said. Alrighty, FedEx 227 from Pro Wrestling Only said, I think there's far more good around the world in 1994 than bad. Speaking specifically in America, I really enjoyed WWF's main event offerings all year, including a perfectly built Owen versus Brett half-year-long feud, Yoko's last run on top, and a lot of decent matches on Raw featuring Razor, 1-2-3 Kid, Diesel's rise, Shawn Michaels' rise, and more. 1994 WCW, yeah, first half is a lot of fun, then Hogan's bros come in, and it kind of goes to shit. We've hit the Hogan point. In terms of TV for WWF on Raw, the classic Brett versus 1-2-3 Kid match gets a lot of love. The 1-2-3 Kid and Razor versus Shawn and Diesel match on the Action Zone, which you mentioned earlier on. There was a lot of good guys in the middle. They're all kind of trying to find their place. The click was coming together here.
The worrying thing is about TV there. The way we can easily just pinpoint those good matches speaks to me how poor in a lot of respects TV was.
Yeah.
I think we've talked about this before. If you go back and watch 1993 Monday Night Raw, that is superior to Raw 94
by miles.
As an overall show, it's much better
by miles. It's far more dynamic, it's far more exciting. There's a whole different vibe to it in 93. It felt like they were actually trying to do something different. 1994 is back to TV as usual, it felt like, in many respects.
It was almost Wrestling Challenge with the Raw logos.
Yeah, exactly. And again, to Rick Morris's point about the gimmicks, because there was such an infiltration of guys like Men on a Mission And these kind of wacky characters.
Drosy,
Jarrett, who still felt like a cartoon at that point to me.
Didn't you love Jarrett?
I think I was the only Jeff Jarrett fan in the world, because looking back at the tapes, he's really not very over at all.
If I'm getting on the Lex Express on this podcast,
you're gonna stick with, thank you very much.
I think there's two fans of Jeff Jarrett, because you always have to count himself as well.
Alright, last from Pro Wrestling Only, mentioned a couple of good things here. It's worth talking about Tonya Harding, OJ Simpson, and the Singapore Canings. All of these promotions are exploiting current events like crazy. It was like the news was tailor-made for pro wrestling at the time. One thing he didn't mention there,
George Foreman
becoming the boxing champion at 45, tied into Backlund winning at 45, same age. The Tonya Harding angle they did at the Clash with Flair and Hogan. The Singapore Kane and ECW with a Dreamer and Sandman. There was a lot of pop culture kind of tie-ins. It's like they were trying to reach for anything that would connect in 94.
It was mentioned there because you talk about the Singapore Caning and that sort of perfectly sums up the ECW WWF contrast to me.
Yeah, it does.
Especially for that, you've got ECW trying to go with the cutting edge. The fact that US Citizen was going to receive a caning, they tie it into their storyline as a way to try and get Dreamer over with the fans who hadn't taken to the guy with the spandex and pants.
Kieran still hasn't taken to him.
Oh, clearly.
Fucking hate you, fat fuck Tommy Dreamer. Nothing personal, but I personally hate you.
But that aside, you've got ECW trying that, which is groundbreaking and violent, and the cage with the blinding angle with the Sandman, like you say. Then you've got the WWF's attempt to tie in, and their way of almost tying in with OJ Simpson is to bring in Leslie Nielsen as the character from the Naked Gun series. Doesn't that just perfectly contrast the two?
Charles from Pro Wrestling Only, I do love this here, this feedback. It was a classic year for All Japan, with the Misawa Kawada feud reaching full flower and Doc Williams hitting his peak as the top American. All Japan in this year is absolutely out of this world. The June 3rd 1994 match with Mitsuhara Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada.
Watch it.
Last week I mentioned Monster Rusamov versus Strong Kobayashi. This week, if you haven't seen this match, Mitsuhara Misawa, Toshiaki Kawada, June 3rd 1994, one of the best matches of all time. I absolutely adore this match.
Watch it.
He also elaborates, and you know what, before I go anywhere else, All Japan in general, those tag matches with Misawa and Kobashi against Taue and Kawada the same year.
Fucking beautiful.
Unbelievable stuff.
I think a lot of those matches would probably rank highly in our matches of the year.
They are easily. I think the top 10 would be filled with them.
Go ahead. No, my personal favourite is always Men on a Mission against the Quebecers.
WrestleMania 10, yeah. In New Japan, Tenryu beat Inoki at the Dome and then blew off the War New Japan feud in grand fashion by jobbing to Hashimoto in a great match. It was a sneaky good in-ring year for WCW with the strong shows in the first half of the year and the Dustin Stud stable feud carrying it. Love it or hate it, the Big Egg Joshi show on November the 20th was quite the spectacle. That was the show I referenced before, the Big Egg Wrestling Universe, which is an all-women show, 42,500 fans, a complete spectacle if you've never seen it. It's a very unique show, very different show. You had Vader invading UWFI to fun effect. In Lucha, When Worlds Collide was a gateway drug for some US fans, whether you think the main event holds up as a classic or not. the main match that everyone remembers from that show is Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr versus Octagon and El Hijo del Santo. A match that pretty much broke Eddie Guerrero into American wrestling, because ECW picked him up because of that match. Fantastic 2 out of 3 falls matches on the Eddie Guerrero DVD. I do hate the fact that Art Barr died very, very shortly after this show, because I love Art Barr at One Worlds Collide.
He surely would have been signed as well, same as Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah, well, Heyman was trying to bring him in together to feud with the Public Enemy. Yes, the Public Enemy in 1994 was also a key one. Fans of Public Enemy around the table?
No.
I haven't even got sympathy for him, and the Acolytes beat the shit out of him.
But again, it reinforces the point that there was more good wrestling elsewhere in the world. Otani's jacket from Pro Wrestling Early says, "The good... Owen versus Brett, Larry Zbysko versus Regal, and Dustin versus the Stud Stable, three of my favourite feuds from the 90s. The bad, CMLL being in the doldrums while AAA wasted all of Mexico's talent with shitty booking, and the hubris of the Big Egg Show and the decline of Joshi Wrestling. The ugly, Hogan era WCW, Tony and Bobby on commentary, and UWFI, which may well be the Hogan era of shoot style wrestling." I do love that. Hey, the Vader Takada match is in 94. That's pretty awesome. Imagine August. That's like one of the last classic Vader matches in that shoot style. Seth A2 from TPWWForums.com also mentions the good. All Japan was putting on awesome matches with guys like Misawa, Kobashi, Taue, Kawada, Akiyama, Dr. Death, and Shane Douglas kicks off ECW's Extreme Era by throwing down the NWA World title. ECW, again, we kind of mentioned it briefly before with the Sandman and Dreamer. Douglas in 1994 was kind of ECW, Sabu too. This was really kind of, this was Heyman's first full year booking ECW, and he created a lot of guys. We mentioned Public Enemy, Sabu, Douglas here, rechristening him, rebranding him the franchise, and treating him like a top guy. This is probably the best Shane Douglas ever was. I'm not a big Shane Douglas fan, but what are your thoughts on Shane Douglas around this time?
I'm not his biggest fan by any stretch, but I think, like you say, that's probably him at his peak. Some of the other talent as well, like Two Cold Scorpios getting his wrestling regularly there.
Yep.
You've got Cactus and Sabu, which had sort of the big underground swell of supporters. So that hardcore dream match at the time.
Yeah.
And you've got the Tasmaniac as well.
Well,
hadn't quite found himself, but
not quite.
But,
no.
But he'd, you know, that was his sort of foot in the door. I think that's the case for ECW in '94. It's a lot of guys getting the exposure, getting to grips with things before they really sort of become the counterculture and the revolution in 95 when Raven comes in and it's sort of off to the races they go.
I think Shane Douglas was quite important. I can understand probably why he's not your favourite guy ever on the ECW roster, but I think at that exact time he was very important to him, because Paul Heyman wanted, you know, wrestlers with passion, and that's kind of what Shane Douglas had, because obviously he just hated WCW. And, you know, Paul Heyman was great at harnessing that anger and turning it into passion for what would eventually become the Extreme Championship Wrestling product.
Did Sabu win the Observer Wrestler Year?
If he didn't, and Meltzer... I remember Meltzer made the quote one time of how the best wrestler in the world in 94 was not Bret Hart, it was Sabu.
That's ridiculous.
Thank you, Paul Heyman, for your great,
yeah,
your great swindling there.
That's the point I was going to make, is this... I think maybe... Two things, obviously... being the counterculture to WF, WCW, give ECW the legs up kind of thing, but also this, you see the start of the auras that were getting made about guys like Public Enemy and Sabu, and the greatest act that Heyman never pulled wasn't his booking, it was the perception and marketing around his talent to these guys were a lot better than they really were.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of these guys got exposed when they went other places. The thing with Shane Douglas as well, the reason I don't like him is because when he's doing the whole, you know, Dick Flair stuff, it always felt so forced to me that this guy was like trying to say that he was held down and he should have been a top guy, because away from the ECW environment, I never thought this guy's really got what it takes to go to be the top guy in the WWF.
That's it, I've never really, maybe someone at the top can explain it to me, I've never really got my head around just exactly how he was held down. He was given the rubber being Steamboat's partner. What did he really think he was held back from? Because, like you say, when you're looking, you don't think there's a guy that's being held back. You think there's a guy, oh, he's in that spot. I wouldn't really do any more or any less with him.
Yeah, he wasn't bad. He contributed to those great matches with the Blondes, where it's him and Steamboat against Pillman and Austin.
They're good matches, but he's clearly the number four guy in the match.
All right, going to break through some of the thing. Doorho 6 from Pro Wrestling Only. June 3rd, 94 has to be mentioned specifically, Misawa and Kawada. The Super J Cup 94 was pretty fun as well. A man with a very regrettable username, The Rabid Wolverine from Wrestling Forum.
Need to change that one.
Yeah, one of the best years ring work-wise in WCW. What, Spring Stampede 94 sometime? Just fabulous stuff. CD player from Wrestling Forum. The good, Brett vs. Owen. The bad, Taker vs. Taker. The ugly, Diesel Squash and Backlund. The good, here from a Yeah Baby at Wrestling Forum. Diesel's slow build. Diesel in 94, they booked him. If you actually look at it with long-range vision, at the Rumble in 94, when they had him as the monster, at King of the Ring, they had him against Brett, SummerSlam, they always protected Diesel. They actually very slowly brought him along very well.
Slow build, but wasn't he like the Grand Slam champion within a year? Didn't he win like all three major titles within a year?
Oh yeah.
How is that a slow build?
Because they didn't hotshot him to the world title straight away.
No, I can see where the I can see where he's coming with that, because he wasn't hot shotted. It was sort of, it was slightly more gradual than you make it sound there. To use, you're pulling faces, but okay, let's look at
Chase,
this way.
By the way, not me.
Yeah, Chase is pulling some strange faces, but look at it this way, Chase. Nash comes in, he's the bodyguard. They don't overexpose him in matches, they use him very strategically, like has been alluded to there. Compare that with Yokozuna. Yokozuna comes in at Survivor Series 92, crushes Virgil, wins the Rumble.
Which is glorious, by the way.
Oh, it absolutely is.
Career highlight.
Virgil hasn't been crushed like that since back in Patterson's office.
Oh, God!
Allegedly.
Allegedly. But no, Yoko comes in, beats Virgil, wins the Rumble, wins at Mania, okay, loses it in, what was it, 9 seconds?
Something ridiculous.
But then quickly wins it back at King of the Ring and then holds it through till Mania 94. Mm. Yeah, there's quite a difference there to use those two as a comparison.
From that time period, from being a bodyguard at WrestleMania to winning the title just after Survivor Series, for me, that's pretty fast track.
Yeah, but in comparison to what they do with other people, that was a slow build. Look what they did with Hogan.
Yeah.
Now, that one worked out like gangbusters, but look at what they did. Brought him in straight away, clothesline leg drop. He's the champion after a cup of coffee back in the company. Brock Lesnar's another example.
Yeah.
Comes in April, by August he's world champion.
Beating The Rock. Alright, we're going to move on to my final talking point, which is going to be the steroid trial. The 1994 steroid trial of Vince McMahon and the WWF for the conspiracy to distribute steroids to its wrestlers, which, in fact, Vince McMahon was very, very close to doing some serious hard time. I think that it's really, really interesting when you look at the state of the business. Dr. George Zahorian, a name that's very familiar to a lot of the people, and he's getting a lot of smiles around this table right now. The notorious Pennsylvania drug dealer doctor was dispensing his many pharmaceutical goods to many WWF wrestlers, and Vince ended up in hot water. Up until around WrestleMania 10, it seemed like they had great focus. They were really building that show really well. They did a great job showing video packages detailing the history and the tradition of WrestleMania. The build to Bret Hart and the storytelling there was very good. Right after WrestleMania 10, things kind of took a little bit of a detour where Vince was tied up with the courtroom stuff.
The way we've talked about WWF 94, I think your point sort of underpins it a lot, because I think it's the first time that Vince truly sort of takes his eye off the ball.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. He's bogged down in the court case.
He wasn't even at King of the Ring 94.
He wasn't at King of the Ring 94. Oh. The rumour mill at the time was that he was preparing Jerry Jarrett.
He's going to hand the company over to him.
Hand the company over to run for safekeeping.
I wonder who he would have put on top.
Well, I don't want to name any names, but I think this sort of underpins the whole argument. It's the current behind why WWF 94 in a lot of ways is so shitty.
The impact of the steroid trial in 1994 was pretty massive, because at the same time, WCW, no policy there. They can do whatever the fuck they want. They weren't under any scrutiny. So Hulk Hogan and all of his friends could just swan right in and do whatever they wanted.
It's like you say, it's the emphasis on physique there as well. And one of the probably key reasons they went with Diesel is because he's a big guy, and Vince still has his obsession with big guys.
Yep.
But he's got a more natural physique, because his bigness inverted commas comes from his tall height.
The focus on guys like Yoko and Taker instead of guys like Bret and Owen, who were smaller guys. And even though they got a chance, they got their first real chance. Bret was probably the star of the company, especially when it came to drawing on the road. This whole thing, this whole notion about smaller wrestlers getting a chance, do you think that it was a period that Vince had to endure in his mind?
It's still synonymous to this day. When a guy, some guys are used for functional purposes, and some guys are booked around them, depending on how they see the future's going to go. And I think Bret probably slipped into that category of he wasn't a guy who had the full faith. He wasn't being booked to 100%, you know, with a focus going forward. And I think it showed. It always shows.
It showed. And again, let's just go into the point about the steroid trial, the negative publicity and the impact that had on the WWF. WWF was already facing a downturn in popularity, and then they were getting hammered from all sides, especially when they started making the news with Hulk Hogan taking the stand and stuff like that. Again, it impacted the WWF negatively because they were seen at the time as the market leader, even though Hogan was WCW bound.
Well, when you're looking at like Vince being absent, I think probably the lowest point for me looking back on 94 is probably King of the Ring 94. I mean, you just gotta look at the quality of that show. I know like probably Carl like hates Survivor Series. Carl hates Survivor Series. For me, like I've seen bits and bobs of Survivor Series, but when watching like the entire show back, for me it was King of the Ring. I mean, that was just like, there was only two good matches on that show, and you had the abomination that was bloody Art Donovan in commentary, which you just got to know that if Vince was there, okay, he would have put him out there for the commentary. He would have done one match. Vince would have realized, holy shit, we need to get this guy off. And he would have thrown him off after the first match.
He would have hired Jim Ross to fire him again. He'd be so angry.
Yeah, but like, because he wasn't there, some dipshit, whoever was in charge back then, just thought, nah, it's okay, he can only get better throughout the night. And guess what? He can't. He looks like a boxer.
Gorilla Monsoon was glorious on that show. Gorilla, one of the great barriers of all time, just cutting off Art Donovan, saying, sorry Art, I can't hear what you're saying, and then just going on to his own point because we didn't want to answer this poor guy.
It tells you how bad it is when Macho Man, who was like a saint that night, you know, even he was running out of patience for Art. Where, I can't remember the exact quote, but even he turned around to Art and says, I completely agree with you apart from everything you've just said.
James Steele from TPWW Forums mentions the ugly Lex Luger to Tonka Who Sold Out feud. Do you think this is a little harsh to call this ugly? I quite like this.
I think I've said all I need to say about Lex Luger for the duration of this podcast.
You're referencing the SummerSlam match.
Tatanka's
heel turn.
Yeah, Tatanka's heel turn. Yeah. The whole thing was Tatanka, you know, saying that Luger was the one who sold out. They did all these little subtleties, and it's very funny. It was a nice little undercard thing.
I liked it. I enjoyed it. Because I guess, like, when I was watching it back, because I do remember Tatanka when just before I did stop watching, but, like, looking back at that, it surprised me when I watched it. I thought, really? They're going to turn him heel?
Don't you think it's very emblematic? At SummerSlam 93, he's in the main event and he wins by count out, balloons falling. The next year, he's losing to a heel turn to Tonka.
Do you think the balloons were supposed to fall? Do you think, like, someone leant on the button? Like they there? If he won the title, they were supposed to fall? It's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Press it anyway.
Yeah, what to do?
How are we going to go home?
Press the damn thing anyway. Honorable mentions also the Austin Steamboat feud, which hasn't been mentioned all that much, but a great, great, great series of matches, even though I do feel, you know, it got cut short, unfortunately. The end of Steamboat's career is a massive negative for this year.
And I think it's... I'd repressed the memory of Steamboat's career ending in 94. It's so painful to me even now.
Rick Rude too!
Rick Rude? Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Right.
His dishonourable mentions were Rick Rude and Steamboat both getting career-ending injuries and Team Loyola versus Team Doink at Survivor Series. Slinky Tricky Damon from TPWW. The good. Bret Hart versus the 1-2-3 Kid from Raw. Bret versus Owen feud for the title in WrestleMania 10. The bad. Hogan arrives and starts calling WCW the WCW. Always sounded really dumb when anyone said the WCW, and Sting and Luger were also repeat offenders. The ugly Bastian Booger was still around, so I'll say him.
I've got to agree, first of all, about the WCW thing. That really...
Bret Hart used to do that a lot as well.
Yeah, it really grinds my gears, that does.
Gary Thompson from Facebook. The good, HBK and Razor, agrees with you. Yeah. The bad, Backlund is champion, agrees with you, Carl. Yeah. The ugly, Men on a Mission.
Yeah, let's just move past
Men. Trust me, Men on a Mission would get a hell of a lot more offensive in 1995.
Yeah.
Honourable mention goes to Austin Steamboat. Dishonourable mention goes to Hulk Hogan in general. Jerry Batson, this is a good one, you'll love this. The ugly Thunder in Paradise. I can't believe that wasn't mentioned by anybody. That's a great call.
God.
As a child, I insisted on this being rented from Blockbuster.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, we're certainly learning a lot about the people around this table this evening.
I think it's the only time that was rented by Blockbuster.
Kind of undermines everything I've said about Lex Luger, I suppose.
It certainly does, doesn't it? Yeah, you chose Thunder, the crime-solving boat, over the Lex Express. So I'm not really sure what that says. So, running across the board here, we've looked at a lot of different things here. WWF, WCW, ECW, overseas. The good, the bad, and the ugly of this year is pretty immense. So we're going to go around the table now. Kieran, what are you calling your personal good, bad, and ugly? You can only select one thing. What epitomises each for you? The best, the worst, and the most hideous.
The best, Shawn Michaels coming to my attention. Personal
choice, obviously. Actually, no. All Japan was much better.
Was better?
Yeah, I really did.
Wow.
Retrospectively, I mean, All Japan tag matches are just beautiful.
Out of this world.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And they and you know, you could say with a... Maybe hold up better today, a little better than the ladder match.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's tough to say.
You're probably right.
In terms of modern style, I think it holds up better. I think if you were there at the time, the ladder match, you can just watch all day, because we certainly did at the time.
Yeah. The bad, I will go for... Hogan. Hogan's effect, non-pay-per-view buy rate-wise, on WCW in the second half of the year, because it was atrocious. The ugly... The steroid trial, scar on the face of wrestling, bigger than anything else.
Yeah. You can thank Hulk Hogan for that, by the way.
Yeah, thanks, brother.
Thanks, brother. I love the fact that he started the whole thing. Isn't this classic Hogan? He starts the whole thing by lying on Arsenio Hall. He somehow sidesteps the Zahorian trial, testifies in the Vince trial, and then fucks off to WCW.
Oh, my text is here, brother.
And then WWF takes all the heat, and Vince is left there. Yeah. Hogan gets off scot-free. Even though he's the one that lied. Classic Hogan.
Man, that guy knows how to work, doesn't he? He worked everybody.
He doesn't miss a fucking trick. Wasn't he on...
Everyone was jobbing to him.
Wasn't he on... You mentioned he's on the World Cup video.
Yeah, he's on the World
USA.
I don't know if...
I've seen it.
He even
I've
got his it, yeah. What you gonna do and everything. He was there.
He doesn't miss a million trick.
Millions of belts, little NWA t-shirt. And I had no idea what he was doing there. Just... There he was.
Okay,
on the
BBC. So you're going for the good, All Japan, the bad... WCW with Hogan there,
yep.
And the ugly, the steroid trial.
Yeah. Three nice, easy, obvious ones, because I went first.
Carl?
Yeah, thanks for that, you son of a bitch. I don't want to try and piggyback too much, but wrestling outside of North America for the good, the bad, WWF's pay-per-view offerings, for all the hideous nature of Hogan's in-ring stuff in the second half of WCW, at least you got that first good half of the year, the offerings they produced. And the ugly for 94, it's got to be the steroid trial. I'd be surprised if that's not unanimous around the table, considering the black eye and the damage to the already less than stellar reputation it did for the business.
Yeah.
Chase? I can actually put all three of them down all in one pay-per-view. I'd actually describe SummerSlam 94 as being, for me, the epitome of good, bad and the ugly of 1994. I mean, you look at that pay-per-view, and for me personally, because I got a lot of nostalgia for that show, the good is obviously the Bret Owen cage match. Also, I'm very fond of the Hall, Razor Ramon Diesel match with Shawn Michaels at ringside. I really loved that match for
one man show from Shawn.
Yeah, but yeah, Shawn Michaels was fantastic.
I need to add my good. Owen's crotching in that cage match. Was it the cage match? When did
that's the Action Zone match.
Okay,
it's the last match, and Owen gets shoved on the foot and then jumps about 5 feet.
Oh,
crotches himself. It's
the greatest moment in wrestling history.
Funniest thing.
Yeah. So going back to what I was saying. Yeah, SummerSlam being the good and the bad, and the ugly. Good for the cage match, for Diesel versus Razor Ramon, and for Lundra Blaze versus Bull Nakano. Definitely check that match out. The bad, yeah, you're looking at what the Head Shrinkers versus Bam Bam and IRS, and for some people, Lex Luger versus Tatanka,
Mabel and Jarrett,
yeah, and the, just the downright ugly, which I think everyone can agree with, which has been on the sheet you've been reading off. Undertaker versus Undertaker. So for me, SummerSlam 94 best personifies the good and the bad and the ugly of 94.
All right, the good, I'm going to go with All Japan as well. No, you know what, WrestleMania 10, and it is personal bias. I'm going to say right now, it's personal bias. I love that show. I love the narrative of the show. I love the key matches on the show. I think of the. Among the all-time classics, I slight lean towards All Japan and the Misawa Kawada match, but personal bias, I have to go with WrestleMania 10. The bad, I'm going to go with Hogan destroying Flair in WCW, because that did massive damage. I mean, look at 1995, for Christ's sake. It's a direct effect of Hogan coming in and doing what he did with Flair. 1995, again, different podcast for a different day. Hogan, Flair dressed as a woman to do a running on Hulk Hogan. The Dungeon of Doom. Do I need to elaborate? I don't think so, folks. I'll say that for bad. Ugly, I'm going to go with The Undertaker all year. I think everything The Undertaker did was pretty hideous. I hate the angle at the start of the year. I hate the Taker thing. I know that some people really love Yokozuna, and I don't want to offend anybody because I do think he was a good big man in his way, but that match was no good.
Yeah, it was a considerably bad year for Undertaker. It really was. Would you say that was the worst year for Undertaker?
95.
It's been against Kama the Supreme Fighting Machine wasn't much better.
Well, against Mabel, Bundy, IRS, the shit he had to go through in 95 was absolutely just... ECW was coming to life, WF and WCW were struggling to find their place, Japan was thriving. Different times, folks, different times. I want to thank everybody around the table, I want to thank you all for the feedback you've sent. G. John Chase.
See ya.
Carl Jones.
I need a drink.
Kieran O'Rourke.
I've had a drink.
I'd like to thank you very much for all listening up to this point. On the next episode of Squared Circle Gazette Radio, we're going to do a very, very different concept. We are going to have the first ever SCG court case, where we are going to put on trial Triple H for crimes against the wrestling industry.
He didn't do it.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. We're going to have a prosecution, we're going to have a defense, we're going to have a judge, we're going to talk about Triple H's career. I'm a part of the prosecution, along with Carl Jones. Kieran O'Rourke and Luke Edwards are the defense. Judge G. John Chase will preside, and we are going to try him. We are going to put Triple H on trial for crimes against the wrestling business, that his in-ring career was more of a detriment to the company than a benefit. We're going to find out. We're going to break it down. Again, thank you very much for listening. Thank you, everyone here. And we are out of here.